Sociologists tell us that we come to an understanding of whom we are partly by deciding who we aren't, a process of differentiating. I tried to think of the categories that seem to apply, male or female, smart or ignorant, liberal or conservative, agnostic or believer, American or foreigner, flexible or rigid, popular or outsider, bigoted or open, tall or short, fat or thin, a success or a failure, thinker or feeler, cooperative or hostile, industrious or lazy, straight or gay, smoker or non-smoker, vegetarian or meat eater, Unitarian Universalist or Christian, extrovert or introvert, white collar or blue collar, able-bodied or disabled, techie or Luddite, caring or unsympathetic, attractive or unattractive, and most importantly, someone who divides people into two kinds or not. The reality is, of course, that there are some qualities about which we have no choice. Some would suggest that we actually have no choices. Between genetics and environment, we are dealt a hand of cards which we must play. We don't get to choose male or female, for instance, although, of course, there are today instances of people who are convinced that their genitalia do not match who they really are and can go through reassignment. We are finally recognizing the validity of that. In fact, most of those criteria are not either-ors, but a matter of how far along the continuum. It's also true that some of those categories have more impact than others. Sociologists point out that cultures place more value on some identities than others. Zygmunt Bauman asserts that identities are set up as dichotomies. He points out that woman is the opposite, the other of man. Animal is the other of human. Stranger is the other of native. Abnormality, the other of norm. Deviation, the other of law-abiding. Illness, the other of health. Insanity, the other of reason. Lay public, the other of the expert. Foreigner, the other of state subject. And enemy, the other of friend. He asserts that social order is based on the fact that in each pair, one side is considered the standard, and the other is considered just that, the other, an inferior, one that is not like us. Simone de Beauvoir wrote that otherness is a fundamental category of human thought. Thus it is that no group ever sets itself up as the one without at once setting up the other over against itself. The one, the standard, is, of course, considered superior, and the other inferior. Religions, the law, media, education generally reinforce those values. It's certainly clear that in our culture, males, as de Beauvoir points out, were considered for a long time to be the standard, and women were secondary and therefore inferior. Thus, the book of Genesis has the male created first and the female created to care for them. Judaism and Christianity have for centuries depicted the female as inferior, the other. Women have had a circumscribed role, and it has not been the role with the most power. A woman who considered herself as equal or, heaven forbid, superior to a male had to be restrained. The language has been clear. How has Homo sapiens been referred to? Mankind. With rare exceptions, women have been denied leadership roles, have been considered intellectually inferior, and even to this day, as we know, commonly paid less than men for doing the same work. There have been some countries that have been ahead of the United States in recognizing the equality of women, but conservative forces in this country continue to insist that this world would be better if women knew and accepted their inferior place. Change has come about slowly in this country, but it is happening at last. There is, of course, another us them majority minority relationship, which has been even more fraught with tons of superior inferior baggage and has even been more resistant to change. It is, of course, the category which revolves around skin color. People were brought to this country from Africa to serve as slaves, to do the work no one else wanted to do, and certainly not so cheaply. It is hard to imagine placing human beings in such an inferior role and treating them so inhumanely. And so it was decided that they, like the natives who lived here before the Europeans arrived, were not truly human. A war was fought 150 years ago to bring an end to slavery. But that war accomplished far less than many thought it should have. There were modest improvements in some parts of the country over the years, but the mindset that people of color were less human than those with white skin has hung on for an appalling percentage of the American population. Major advances were finally made during the civil rights era, but that did not put an end to the pernicious racism. The election twice of a president with African ancestors certainly has not put an end to it. On the contrary, that has elicited racism for which they blame him. He is, in the eyes of millions of Americans, the ultimate other, an alien, a heathen. One of the obstacles to change is the determination of those with white skin to believe that racism is behind us, which is to say, to protect the privileges they still enjoy. We have great difficulty in accepting that the deck is still stacked and that racism is alive and well in America today. Now, I am not for a moment suggesting there's been no progress. I am not a fool. But I would suggest that the majority tends to be blind to many of the potent obstacles to fairness that are an everyday part of the lives of many, if not the majority, of African Americans. Change cannot take place when the need for change is denied. There are more black kids in all black schools today than there were before Brown v. Board of Education. There is a phenomenon that education and civil rights groups have dubbed the school-to-prison pipeline. There are big racial differences in how school discipline is meted out. Students of color are much more likely to be suspended or expelled than white students, even when the infractions are the same. A new government study on discipline in the nation's schools released just this spring found that black children make up 18% of preschoolers, but they make up nearly half of all out-of-school suspensions at that level. We're talking about four-year-olds. Across age groups, black students are three times more likely than white students to be suspended. Black students make up 16% of enrolled students, but make up more than a quarter of all students who are referred to the police. There has been some improvement in income. Non-white families earned about half of what white families earned in 1989. In 2010, it increased to 65%. Today, however, white families claim about six times the net worth of non-white families, a gap that has changed little over the past generation. In 2010, the median primary residence for all non-white families, not just homeowners, had about half the value of the homes of white families. Unemployment for whites is at 4.9%, while for African Americans it's 11.1%. A University of Chicago study, really appalling, found that when identical resumes were submitted for job applications, all they did was vary the names so that those which had a black-sounding name had 50% fewer callbacks. A Princeton University study showed that white men with criminal records were more likely to be hired than black men with the same qualifications and no criminal record. The criminal justice system has been severely skewed against African Americans for a long time. A USA Today analysis shows that black people are arrested at a rate 10 times higher than people who are not black, often for the very same crimes for which whites are sent home with a warning. For instance, Van Jones reported in the Huffington Post that although white and black kids have been shown equally likely to carry a weapon, black kids are arrested on weapon charges twice the rate of white kids. Now, all of that stuff is preface to the real crisis that many hope will finally get the attention of white America, or at least of those who are sympathetic to the conditions black Americans face, even while they try to deny them. I'm speaking of the killing of unarmed black Americans by white police and the refusal of the criminal justice system to hold the police accountable. It's not that this is something new. It's been happening for a very long time. But it is finally getting the attention of the white media. Peter Rollins, who's an Irish author who lives now in Los Angeles, in an internet essay asks how we might understand the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson. Can this be seen as a monstrous eruption of a repressed truth? What we see in Michael Brown's tragic death is the exposure of a reality that the political system has invested great energy in trying to forget, that racism is still prevalent. He concludes that most of us not directly affected by the racism in America, or those of us who have benefited from it, don't want to face the difficult questions that the events in Ferguson bring up. But if we close our eyes, ears, and hearts to what is going on, we condemn ourselves. If we turn from the truth that is being glimpsed today in Ferguson, we will continue to walk the path of damnation. But if we face it squarely and allow it to break us, the truth may set us free. Rollins wrote his essay before the Staten Island grand jury followed suit, even in the face of a clear and damning video that clearly showed Officer Daniel Pantello using an illegal chokehold to take down and to cause the death of Eric Garner for the horrific crime of selling untaxed cigarettes. We have the transcript of the Ferguson grand jury, which clearly shows that the prosecutors asked that grand jury to judge Officer Wilson's guilt or innocence, which is clearly, absolutely not the responsibility of a grand jury. Their charge is only to determine if there is probable cause for a trial. The now infamous witness 40, who's the one who supported everything that Officer Wilson said, you will recall, about Michael charging at the policeman. She was a habitual liar, and the prosecutors knew it. She had a habit of coming forward when there were major crime cases, and she would always testify on behalf of the police. And she apparently was not even in Ferguson on the day of the killing. And the prosecutors knew that. And they directly lied to the jury about the content of the applicable statute. And this is what we call justice. We don't have the details from the Staten Island grand jury, but it appears that there, too, the jury was encouraged to act as if it were a trial jury, which it wasn't. And then there's the case of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland, about which the police have lied repeatedly. A rookie officer who had resigned from a nearby department when he was going to be fired for incompetence shot and killed Tamir within, they've got a video, he shot and killed Tamir within 2 seconds of arriving on the scene, clearly having failed to assess the situation. He says he thought the 12-year-old was 20. It has not yet been decided how that case will or will not proceed. It is hard for white folks to fully grasp the degree to which many, possibly most black Americans, on the basis of their experience, view police as the enemy, another us and them. That's not to suggest that every police officer is racist, but it is far beyond just a few bad apples in the barrel. In a Mother Jones article on the science of why cops shoot young black men, Chris Mooney writes that an impressive body of psychological research suggests that the men who killed Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin need not have been conscious, overt racists to do what they did, though they might have been. The same goes, he says, for the crowds that flock to support the shooter every time these tragedies become public. It was Mooney's article that reminded me of the discomforting implicit association test. And in fact, there is an address given on the order of service. You may want to take it with you, I hope. It's a test I had encountered on the internet a couple of years ago, and I had put it out of my mind. Why? Well, as many of you know, who've known me almost all my life, I was raised in a very liberal home by parents who were emphatically opposed to racism. While we lived in virtually all white neighborhoods, they occasionally entertained black friends, including one of the singers, actually from the group, Sweet Honey in the Rock, I blocked on. Reagan, Bernice Reagan, was in Albany one time, and she came to our home. We were active in this almost all-white Unitarian Universalist church. It has improved. In my day, we had the token Cunningham family. He was a doctor who ultimately, that family left the church because our then minister, James Madison Barr, a libertarian, actively opposed fair housing legislation that would tell him to whom he could sell his home. Now, when Jim moved, he did sell his home in a white neighborhood to a black family because no one was going to tell James Madison Barr to whom he could sell his home. My grade school was all white, reflecting the neighborhood. We did finally have one black girl from the Albany Home for Children in my class, and we became friends. Hackett Junior High School and Albany High had significant numbers of black students, but only a very few of them were in my college entrance classes. And then I attended St. Lawrence University, which had not one African-American student. There was one African, Ben Jomga. I was active on a committee to push the administration to bring black students to the campus. The dean told us that, in fact, students of color were accepted, but they always declined to attend when his office suggested that they might not really feel welcome there. In fact, in a public meeting, he told us, actually, he said, the problem is it's too cold in Canton for them. When I pointed out that just across the driveway was SUNY Canton, then called ATI, and they seemed to have a whole lot of black students, and why was it warmer on that side of the driveway than ours? He didn't have a response to that. My strong commitment to racial justice, with which I was raised, has continued throughout my ministry, and I've been frustrated by the token number of people of color in almost all of our congregations. Now, I share all of this not to pat myself on the back, but to explain why it is that I have always chafed at the suggestion that white folks need to acknowledge the impact of their subconscious racism. Certainly not moi. And then I encountered this IAT online. I put it out of my mind rather quickly because it obviously was flawed when it judged me to have a moderate automatic preference for European Americans compared to African Americans. What? That is not possible, I told myself after I searched my conscious heart and soul. When I encountered that test referred to in Mooney's Mother Jones article on the police, I decided I needed to take it again because it must have been a bad day. And then I took it two more times, and each time the outcome was the same. Mooney describes the test, and this doesn't become completely clear, but at least it'll give you an indication. The test asks you to rapidly categorize the images of faces as being either African-American or European-American, and then it intersperses category words, or asks you to categorize words like evil, happy, awful, and peace as being either good or bad. Faces and words flash rapidly on the screen, and you have to tap a key as fast as you can to indicate which is the right category. Sometimes you're asked to sort African-American faces and good words, to one side of the screen, and other times black faces are to be sorted with bad words. As words and faces keep flashing by, you struggle to not make too many sorting mistakes. And then suddenly you have a horrible realization. When black faces and bad words are paired together, you feel yourself becoming faster in your categorizing, an indication that the two are more easily linked in your mind. Now, I was never conscious of that linkage. "You think of yourself as a person who strives to be unprejudiced," he said. "Yes, indeed. But you can't control these split-second reactions. As the milliseconds are being tallied up, you know the tale they'll tell. When negative words and black faces are paired together, you're a better, faster categorizer, which suggests that racially biased messages from the culture around you have shaped the very wiring of your brain. The results page of the IAT points out that the test often reveals associations that are different from one's conscious beliefs. For example, even people who have no conscious preference between black and white may still have implicit associations that white is better than black. Depending on the magnitude of your result, your automatic associations may be described as slight, moderate, strong, or little or no preference. How implicit associations affect our judgments and behaviors is not well understood and may be influenced by a number of variables. As such, the score should serve as an opportunity for self-reflection, not as a definitive assessment of your implicit thoughts or feelings." I don't know what they included in that update on the newsletter, but I did this sermon, or a slightly different version of it, in Central Square at the beginning of December. And one of the black members of the church took the test, and she was relieved to find out that she had a strong preference for black folks. She's married to a white guy and works in a white environment, and she was afraid that maybe she had become corrupted. So she was happy that she still had the identity strongly that she had. The point of this test is that it demonstrates that many white Americans are less than fully objective when it comes to matters of race, and particularly to white privilege, than we think we are because of our experiences, or lack thereof. This could impact the actions of all of us, including police officers who are often faced with making split-second decisions. As a matter of fact, studies specifically designed to measure the likelihood that police officers will think they see guns in the hands of unarmed black people than in the hands of unarmed white people. And they often see no guns in the hands of white people, while more clearly seeing the guns of armed black people. Now, the upside of these studies, depressing as they are, is that there seems to be indication that training can, in fact, reduce those errors. And that certainly would be more likely in those whose racial distortions are subconscious rather than those who are consciously convinced of the greater likelihood that black people will be armed and dangerous. It's fascinating that back in 1946, Albert Einstein wrote a letter to America in which he reported that he was concerned, as a new American, that it appeared to him that there is a somber point in the social outlook of Americans. Their sense of equality and human dignity is mainly limited to those of white skins. The more I feel American, the more this situation pains me. Many a sincere person will answer, "Well, our attitude toward Negroes is the result of unfavorable experiences which we've had by living side by side with Negroes in this country. They are not our equals in intelligence, sense of responsibility, or reliability." Einstein said, "I'm firmly convinced that whoever believes this suffers from a fatal misconception. Your ancestors dragged those black people from their homes by force, and in the white man's quest for wealth and an easy life, they have been ruthlessly suppressed and exploited, degraded into slavery. The modern prejudice against Negroes is the result of the desire to maintain this unworthy condition." Einstein concluded, "I do not believe there is a way in which this deeply entrenched evil can be quickly healed. But until this goal is reached, there is no greater satisfaction for a just and well-meaning person than the knowledge that he or she has devoted their best energies to the service of this good cause. One of the worst fictions in which the white majority in America, to which the white majority in America clings, is that we are living now in a post-racial society. Many are utterly convinced that we have gone too far and there are too many preferences for people of color. That belief requires some incredible mental gymnastics, but there are many who find themselves equal to that challenge. Their blinders are not penetrable by the hard, cold facts. The wonderful thing, or one of the wonderful things about the internet, is that you can have access to ideas that challenge your comfortable ignorance. There's a fascinating website called The Theology of Ferguson, and there I found a posting by Jelani Greenidge on "This is what we mean when we say it's about race," parenthetically subtitled, "To the white person who just doesn't see it." The author points out that in most cases, when impassioned people of color are saying that a particular event or issue is really about race, what we're aiming to both uncover and dismantle is the racialized system of interlocking societal institutions that perpetuate these kinds of outcomes. "It didn't surprise me at all," she says, "to find that many of the white citizens and public servants in Ferguson had no idea that there was any kind of racial division in the city, because that's one of the chief aspects of white privilege, the benefit of not having to deal with it if you don't want to. So when we say that this or any other issue is about race, part of what we are asking is for you to go beyond the scope of your experiences when choosing whether or not to validate another person's perspective, because your experiences may not shed enough light on the problem. Just as fish don't understand the concept of water until they're out of it, white people don't usually understand white privilege until they're forced to confront its effects, usually by people of color who are sick of getting the short end of the privilege equation. Consider this: when a person of color, however gently or urgently, tells you that perhaps this is about race, that statement probably wasn't their first reaction. Their first reaction probably looked like this: "Wake the hell up already." I suggested earlier that there was some optimism. I certainly felt it, that the recent demonstrations in response to Ferguson and then Staten Island that have swept the country might be the precursors of real change. And then last weekend, an apparently deranged man with a history of violence and psychiatric hospitalizations assassinated two New York City policemen. And suddenly, this was interpreted as a sign that the exercise of First Amendment rights by those seeking improvements to our justice system had caused the murders. The focus on injustice had simply to stop for a while because it might have motivated him. Does anybody recall similar demands when those two Las Vegas police officers were killed last summer by a Tea Party couple who declared that they were doing this in order to start a revolution? Funny how it's treated differently. We are, of course, told that the lives of police officers are constantly in jeopardy. That's part of the explanation for the problem, and that explains their overreactions. It's interesting to see that there are several lists of the deadliest jobs in America. In 2013, law enforcement did not make the top 10 on most of the lists. Actually, there was one list where it was number 10. For logging workers, there were 91.3 fatalities per 100,000. Fishers and related workers, 75 per 100,000. For roofers, it was 38.7 per 100,000. 10th on the list, on most lists, were construction laborers. But for law enforcement, guess the number. 10 per 100,000. The two New York City policemen who died in the line of duty last weekend were the first to be killed in New York City in 3 years. Nationally, in 2013, police deaths in the line of duty totaled 100 out of an estimated million uniformed officers. Now, any are too many, but the current response is way out of proportion to the reality. It is an attempt to, in fact, help people dodge the real problem. The police unions, which are an intense us as opposed to the them of the civilian population, and the prosecutors who work with the police take the position that their brothers and sisters in blue must automatically be supported. There are no limits. It is disloyal. It's too risky to admit that some in blue uniforms commit reprehensible acts which are, in fact, deserving of prosecution. No reputable civil rights activist or demonstrator has suggested that all police officers are racist, but the dominant culture in some departments is that when police officers turn their backs on a duly elected chief executive, Houston, we've got a problem. I in no way will suggest to you that changing the institutional racism that demonstrably permeates our nation is an easy task. If it were, we wouldn't be having to face the challenges we are. Those who came before us, black and white, have risked and often given their lives to bring about change, change that matters. But the struggle is not over. There is work to be done, uncomfortable work. There is an interesting recent internet appeal by a woman who calls herself Spectra, who appealed to dear white allies, stop unfriending other white people over Ferguson. She says, this is the time to remember that the outrage you feel can in no way match my own, and therefore you have way more emotional capacity than I do to talk some sense into the other side. It may not feel like much. Your empathy may temporarily make you forget that you're not like Michael Brown. You're not one of us. And that's, in fact, you are still one of them. But please try and remember how useful you could be should you decide to be brave enough to speak up to the folks more likely to hear you than me. I'm seeing one too many white people bragging about defending other white people, defriending other white people. I don't need your condolences. I don't need rash actions that absolve you of the responsibility of facilitating hard conversations with folks I will never be able to reach. I need you to step up in a major way and leverage the connections you do have to address ignorance with conversation and to interrogate white privilege with compassion, because I will not do this. I cannot do this. You're a socially conscious white person. You don't share their views. It's disappointing to hear your friends say racist things. You don't want to talk to them. I hear you. I really do. But if you don't speak to them, who will? Who will? Hint, not me. What would a good, forget good, what would a useful, valuable, effective ally do? We need you to be brave now more than ever. Stop with this unfriending. Speak up. Our old hymnal, the blue one, Hymns for the Celebration of Life, contained a hymn with words by Leslie Pinckney Hill, a black poet and educator born in 1890. He was the son of a former slave, and he became a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Harvard. This hymn was not included in the current hymnals because of the unfortunate use of the noun man, in a context that, when he wrote it, was considered inclusive. The hymn went like this. This is the charge I take as mine, the goal of every hope and plan, to cancel the dividing line between me and my fellow man. That so for me all fear shall end, save this, that I may fail to see my neighbor as a needed friend, or sense my neighbor's need for me. Though parliaments may rise and fall, I hold to this eternal good, this deathless truth, that men are all one earth-encircling brotherhood. Friends, there are differences among people, and I would hate for us all to be blandly the same. How boring. But it is our charge, all of us, white and black, male and female, rich and poor, to work to remove the lines that keep us from recognizing our shared humanity at the most important level. You see, there is no us and them. There is only us.